Good morning, once again. It's hard to believe that we're over halfway through. Time certainly flies, or, you know, as the old frog said, time's fun when you're having flies. You know, it really has been a joy to see this many educators, teachers, one place. And I wish to be able to talk to each one of you. It becomes somewhat improbable, a little difficult, the numbers, but I certainly have enjoyed my conversations with you. Especially gratified to have one of our board members here today. Roy, it's good to have you here as well. Yesterday we took a 1,000-year trip, and we talked about a not-so-nice part of history. I hope, though, we found the hand of God. History goes somewhere. There are, of course, different approaches to history. One is that we're just in an endless rolling barrel going in circles. And what happened back then will happen, has happened since then, and will again and again and again and again. I think the Christian should believe that history is going somewhere. I appreciated Anthony's comments. It's headed to a climax someday. There will be no more history textbooks as we know them today, but we'll be worshiping the one whose hand has providentially been in history. Let's not forget that God has been here on this world, and He will continue to be here. I'd like to back up this morning. Actually, today you're going to have to put your reversers on a number of times. I'm going to proceed from a few introductory comments from yesterday. I'd like to proceed from pietism up through 1920s, and then I'm going to back up and say the whole story two different ways, and then I'm going to talk about Anabaptism, which takes us back to 1500 again and moves us to present day. And so hopefully you can stick with me here, but I think that will serve our purposes best this morning. We used some names yesterday that are very important prior to the Reformation. Names like John Wycliffe. Names like John Huss. We talked about the fact that Luther's ideas came from somewhere. He had been influenced. I'd like to talk about this just a moment here. Luther went to school too. And you know how powerful your own school experience is in your teaching. If you haven't taught, trust me, you will work out of something of what you experienced. And that can actually cut two ways. That's sometimes very healthy, and sometimes it's not. Luther actually was educated in the Brethren of the Common Life, or they were known as the Brethren. It's a very conservative Catholic group, and they had very much a pietistic bent to them. And for 200 years, actually, the Brethren controlled hundreds of schools in Holland and Germany. And so it was not actually a typical Catholic school. We heard all about the pagan and how Catholic schools were a certain kind and certain ideals and all of this. But actually, the Brethren school sought to make disciples of the common person. They believed in common man finding God. Each person. Now, the Brethren schools disappeared in the 1500s, actually. But many of the reformers, Puritans, Separatists, like the Pilgrims, actually find their stream in the Brethren movement. And so I think that's important to understand that Luther's ideas came from somewhere. They had shaped him. One other man I should have I mentioned his name, but really probably not adequately, was Erasmus. Lived in Holland. He worked very closely with Martin Luther. Now, he never joined the Protestants in the Reformation, but he was never a darling of the Catholic Church either. They didn't know what to do with the man. He didn't want to leave. He was the most brilliant, one of the more brilliant people that they had. Some made the case that Erasmus laid the framework for which Anabaptism came. Erasmus is extremely important in our own history. I will say that much. Exactly how it works and how it all fleshed out, I'm not going to make the argument. J.D. Douglas said Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. But you see, Luther's ideas changed, actually, with time. Remember? There was a couple reasons why his ideas about education changed. And so I want to remind us that, again, Luther was not acting out of a vacuum. He'd been influenced by individuals. And one of those individuals was Erasmus. We talked briefly about William Tyndale. John Calvin and John Knox, I just mentioned them, I believe. Those two men had a lot to do with education for us today, actually. We're not going to get into that. Now, because of the severity of the persecution, the Anabaptists developed only a few Christian schools. Reed and Prevost say this: much like the first century Christians in Rome, Anabaptists and Mennonites taught the young clandestinely in their homes. Education did not die among the Anabaptists, but it kept changing form. You see, there's probably one distinction, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, is the distinction between what we call education and what we call schooling. And we're going to make a bit of that case tomorrow. But in this whole time of being persecuted and needing to run for their lives, you find education happening and schooling happening, but in the home, in the church. We'll shift to the Pietists. In the 1600s and 1700s, the pious exerted some influence, really, that could be seen somewhat of a reformation of the Reformation. Of course, you have historians talk about the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation. So you have Luther and Zwingli, and then you have, of course, so the Catholics persecuting the Protestants, and then pretty soon the Protestants persecuting the Anabaptists, and you sort of have a whole big messy mess going on in Europe. But Pietism arose, and a very significant Pietist that I'd like to briefly talk about is John Amos Comenius. And it'd be worth your time reading some books about him. He was a Moravian, of which they're part of the oldest evangelical body with an unbroken tradition of Christian school education, and they date back to the Hussites. He was known as the first Christian school missionary. It's kind of interesting. He was a visionary. He also had, to be honest, a bit of a utopic view, some view of perfection in the back of his mind about what education could be. He wrote a remarkable book called The Great Didactic. And basically in there, he talked about a number of things that were very strange for that day, but feel very common to us. He said that students should do most of their study in the morning. That ring true? That was a revolutionary idea. Subjects arranged to suit the age of the students. In other words, you had to fit the curriculum to the child. He thought you should start with what students know and go to what they don't know. And he thought students should stay in school not by how many grades they've been in, but whenever they become well-informed, virtuous, and pious. At that point, they're ready to leave school. Truth be told, sometimes I wonder in the warp and woof of school life if I'd have some students for more than 20 years. But I suppose that's beside the point. He also said that curriculum does matter. What you study from matters. Now, these ideas were, there were historically, there was parts and pieces of these before. He pulled them all together into this very significant work. He believed in the idea that textbooks in education sort of have to be a part of what happens. And so he wrote many, many, many textbooks. Now, of course, there's been a movement back to books, the great books. But he is one who said, we have to have something that will work. And so in a very practical way, he said, well, we need something that will suit our schools, and he did something about it. He believed in a very broad-based education. We're talking about liberal arts, a very broad-based liberal arts education where you know something about many things. Because he thought that students should, when they are done with school, should be able to energetically face life. That they should be adequately responsible for the duties of life that are facing them. And above all, the ultimate intent of education, in his mind, was that the students would be crowned with the fear and love of God. At the end of the day, when it all shook out, that was what mattered to him. So his vision was for Christian schools to call students to become like Christ. Evie, in his book, writes, Comenius considered the Bible to be the basic and most important source of knowledge. To him, education was the means for bringing men to the place where they would accept Christ, and by accepting, become able to fulfill God's purposes for their lives. Education is not a direct agent in conversion. It is only a means whereby conversion may be brought about. He believes that the Holy Spirit was sent to draw men to God, to indwell, to teach, and to guide believers, and that it usually works through parents, teachers, ministers, as natural agents. He said that in every Christian school, the Bible should rank above all other books, and that every youth should be taught its truths from childhood. It was his contention that the Scriptures are equally suitable to all, that they contain truth comprehensible even to little children. In other words, education did not save a person. In 1700, August Hermann Franke, German teacher, wrote this, "All learning and knowledge is folly if it does not have as its foundation true and pure love toward God and man." In other words, education is not to somehow make the person a good person. It is to call people to worship God, to love God with all their heart, soul, and mind, and to love others. These ideas are taking shape. Now, in the post-Reformation era, schools in England had been doing fairly well for some time, but they became more and more nationalized. In other words, the state took them over. At this point, the Puritans were very significant in the regrowth of the Christian school. Puritans were Calvinists. Puritanism steadily grew, largely because they said you should read the Bible. And the English people became more and more a people of the book. God raised up families who said that training children, raising children, is very important. The home, the church, and the school, all three, were centers of schooling for the Puritans. Now, a group within the Puritan strain are the Pilgrims. And you teach about those people, don't you? I hope. Separatists is another word for them. They were not interested in cleansing the state church. The Puritans were. The Puritans said, let's reform something going on here, and let's use what's here. The Pilgrims said, well, we can't fix the state church. The model's wrong. They were like the Anabaptists in that they believed that the church should be made up of only those who made a conscious decision to follow Jesus. Brotherhood was very important to the pilgrims. Now, the English state church did not approve of this very conservative sector of the Puritans. They were hunted, they were jailed, they were kept from having church. Eventually, they moved to Holland as a temporary escape, you might say, away from the persecution. William Bradford actually went with this group to Holland. They saw it as, let's give it some time. Surely things will turn around. So they saw it as a temporary move. Well, here's the problem was that the move to Holland was going nowhere. They were still hunted depending where they were at. So those who were left behind, it was not safe to go back to England. But it became very clear to them that the move to Holland was resulting in acculturation. They were becoming like the Dutch culture. And really, that's the impetus behind, that's the drive behind them coming to America in 1620. The Puritans came about 10 years later. Clarence Benson said, and I quote, "We err when we say that the pilgrims came to America seeking religious freedom. To a certain extent, they enjoyed that liberty in Holland. It would be more accurate to say they came to America seeking an opportunity to give to their children the kind of religious education that was impossible either in England or Holland." And so we see colonial education in America. So now we're talking about 1620 to 1691. Now, the State Church of England attempted education first in this country when they came. Not for its own people, by the way. They did it for the Algonquin Indians. They were concerned that the Indians were so unlearned. Now, this whole thing in colonial education is actually pretty messy. Let me just do a disclaimer, two or three or ten. There is, as colonies developed in America, there's a difference between the South and the North. There's a difference between Virginia, Pennsylvania. There's a lot of... I'm going to make some broad statements that I think they're accurate sort of for the most part, okay? But there's no way to tease out what's going on there in the time I have. So allow me to be a little too general to suit my own tastes here. Now, in many ways, Bible-based Christian schools carried forward the ideas of the leaders of the Reformation. And Elmer Harrison Wilds argues that this really did become the cornerstone of early American education. That there were schools had to do with those ideas, the way they developed them. And you can see John Amos Comenius in the school of that time. Now, there was a unity among the colonists in the goal of a literate community of Bible readers. Schools as we have them today were basically non-existent here. The homeschool approach was taking then, and the only problem was that they saw it wasn't working fairly soon because parent educators were not producing literate Bible readers, people who could actually take the scripture and work with them and believe them. So they said, well, something needs to change. Now, the pilgrims were slower to start schools than the Puritans, partly because the pilgrims did not have a pastor. And remember, the pastors were always very involved in the educational process. These colonial schools lasted 71 years, 1620, 1691. These schools were a little different than what you're used to. They were ungraded schools. In other words, you didn't have first grade, second grade, third grade. Whenever you came to school, we'll start with where you're at, then we'll work from there. So it was very individualized. And the teacher sat at his desk primarily, and students came up to him and did their recitations, did the things they were working on, and they would show their work, and then it would maybe get a beating depending on what they did or didn't do. There was different ways, of course, they approached this. It was either praised or corrected. In this time, there was also secondary grammar schools started, private venture schools, it was tuition-based, there were dame schools for ladies, and pastor schools. Now, teachers in this era were, again, paid very, very poorly, actually. However, they were given high regard in the community. Almost all of them were Harvard graduates. And so they were respected people in the community, it's just they could hardly make a living. In the quest for prosperity, though, did you hear what I just said? In the quest for prosperity, New England's education shifted away from Bible-based learning to vocational preparation. It was about a job. And so, the decline of the Puritan church led to the decline of the Puritan school. Now, in Pennsylvania, the approach to education was different from New England and Virginia. Education was the responsibility of individual churches as opposed to the civil government in the towns. And they religiously, in Pennsylvania, guarded education. They said you need a broad-based education along with religious instruction. Now, Mennonite education in this post-Reformation era, there's a few things we need to say about that. Luther and Zwingli seem to have compromised, but not breaking entirely, with the Catholic Church, especially the issue of accepting state authority in church life. So during the Counter-Reformation, or when the Anabaptists were being persecuted, Pennsylvania looked attractive because there was a possibility of a religious education. So the Mennonites settled in Montgomery, Buck, and Lancaster counties. The Mennonites of this time were committed to Christian school education for its children. They believed that the authority of the school came directly from the church. They first settled in Germantown in 1863. Now, J. Lester Brubaker quotes a Mennonite historian by the name of C. Henry Smith, and I quote him, "The Mennonites are often accused by those who know them least of being opposed to learning. This is not the case. In the early colonial days in Pennsylvania, the Mennonites were among the first to make provision for the education of their boys and girls. In those days, there was no public school system which offered free instruction to all. Education had to be provided either by the various churches of the province or by voluntary subscriptions. In Mennonite communities, the Mennonites were among the first to take the initiative in organizing such voluntary schools, and many of the early meeting houses in Bucks, Montgomery, and Lancaster counties served also as school houses." Interesting, is it not? Now, a major contribution right during this time of the Mennonite education was a new approach to student motivation and classroom discipline. Christopher Dock, and I encourage you to read a book by Christopher Dock. Gerald Studer wrote a book. I wrote a paper on him one time. Got to be 16 pages long. Learned a lot. You need to read about Christopher Dock. He was a gentle, very caring elementary teacher in Skipack, Pennsylvania. And he published a paper, a treatise, on school management entitled Schulordnung. I don't know, however you say that. And it is in that, if you can read that, it's available. You can read everything that's in there. Did you know something? That was some of the most innovative educational progress that had happened. Period. He used the blackboard. A novel idea. Christopher Dock, one of our own. His innovations are seen by almost all historians as far ahead of their time. Maybe partly because we've always been a practical people. I don't know. He seems to me he often, well, what works? In 1783 to 1837, so late 1700s, early 1800s, the evangelical schools and churches fueled whatever spiritual momentum there was in America. Community common schools were the forerunners of the state-operated public schools and were closely allied with the church. Now, these common schools were not as religious in fervor as the central and southern colonies. Southern and central colonies were very concerned about religion. And the North did not see it as much that way at this time. Although it was clearly more prevalent than anything you find in a state-run school today. An overseer of a common school in Connecticut in 1839 wrote this: "We deem it highly important to have a religious influence brought to bear on our children in our schools, that the leading principles of the Christian religion should be inculcated on the mind, that the existence of God may not be forgotten, but constantly recognized, because we believe that knowledge without religion only qualifies the possessor to do the more of evil to his fellow man." In other words, you have to use your mind, but it can't stop with selfish reasons for using your mind. It is meant to serve God and others. It's education is meant for worship. Ultimately calls us to worship. And it was actually the population increase of the poor immigrants of the large cities that had a huge bearing on the start of public schools as we know them. And it was intended to reach students who weren't being reached by the common schools or the private schools. Now, this transition took place over a number of generations, and it was actually not a very easy process. But Horace Mann, and you should read about him, he was a Unitarian. He was absolutely instrumental in these schools' openings. And it seems the first Board of Education had 8 of 11 Unitarians on the board. And from everything one can find, it appears like that was a fairly strategic move. There was a lot of people outside of Unitarians or Universalists. They did not believe in a Trinity. That's the number one bottom line. They didn't believe in a Trinity. There's a lot of other things they didn't believe that you and I believe. Many of our, depending what textbook you use, the righteous founding fathers, deistic Unitarians. We'll leave that. These men were closely tied to Harvard, by the way, which by this time had lost its way. Horace Mann essentially believed that education was the key to solving man's problems. Do you see how different that is? He said, "Let man, who is rational," which is true, we've been built that way, don't always act that way. But he said, "Let man who is rational behave in a rational way, and our problems will go away as we educate our children in perfecting themselves." That was his vision. Is that humanism or what? Now, in this time as well, William McGuffey was born in Western Pennsylvania here. And the introduction of the McGuffey Reader, by the way, there's 120 million copies sold between 1836 and 1930, 100-year period, ranking them third in sales behind the Bible and Noah Webster's Dictionary. McGuffey Reader. Have any of you seen that? Yeah, huh? Let's talk about this in a minute. What it allowed for was age-appropriate reading books with a different text for each grade. Now, it was an amazing work by McGuffey. Because of its wide acceptance, it would be safe to say that the morals each story contained contributed to the culture in a positive way. However, his work actually led the way to widespread acceptance of the public system among Christians. Here's why. On the one hand, you have the Pilgrims and Mennonites with a strong emphasis on religious instruction. We know the ways of God and the fear of God. And on the other side, you have Horace Mann saying, "Whoa, we can really become perfect. We just need to think better." That was a secular education. What McGuffey gave us was a moral education. It was not from a decidedly Christian point of view, but it can, you hear me saying, I'm struggling here to say this. You hear me say it contributed to the cultural good. Good morals, good stories, good, okay. But actually, it was a compromise. It bridged between religious and secular. And that was a significant tool in the acceptance of Anabaptists and many other Christians to accept state-run schools. The mid-1800s, industrialization is cranking. We have improved roads, you have the telegraph, you have steamboats and locomotives. And these dynamic, technologically driven developments brought amazing shifts in the country. Things like slums, the inner city poor. And while, yes, we enjoy many fruits of industrialization, such as this computer and the projector and the microphone and the fact that you could even come because we had roads fit to drive on or planes to fly in, and it brought something else with it too. Public schools had lost the voice of the pastor, and so they lost their ties to the church. An apathy toward education developed as they had more than adequate funding. When schools didn't struggle for money, parents got apathetic, and schools did, and it shifted. I'm not asking for more financial crisis than what we currently have. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow. There were two developments that contributed to momentum for public schools at this time, in the mid-1800s. One of them was the Sunday schools. Actually, Sunday school started as academic schools where they taught the three R's and morals. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and morals. And they were developed for who? Those in the inner city poor, the slums. Why? They were working. Children were working 6 days a week, being forced to work. And so you have a whole host of children who are forced into labor. And they couldn't go to school. So they started Sunday schools, which is a one-hour school to get children to be able to read, write, and do a little math. This is part of the story of how we got to where we are today. Then you have the Lancasterian schools. This does not mean Lancaster County. Joseph Lancaster was a Quaker who wanted to educate the churchless poor. So he had quite the system going on, actually. I don't know if I can describe this adequately or not. Basically, he had classrooms of 800 to 1,000 students in a class, is how he arranged things. And he sat up here, and so there's a row of, let's say, 12-year-old boys. My oldest son's 12. 12-year-old boys, and he would get one of the finest. I think my son's one of those. Okay? I'm proud of him. I'd pull my son out, if I were Joseph Lancaster, and I would tell him what to tell that row of 20 boys. But not just the row of 12-year-olds, not just even the four rows of 12-year-olds, but all the children, he'd give them their instructions. They'd go back. It's neat. They'd go back and tell their other 20 peers what they need to know now, what the assignment was. Can you imagine? Is this going to work? We're in the industrial age. You put him through by the masses. And he found it a very efficient way. His heart was right, I think. He wanted to help the churchless poor. Didn't know how to get it done. And, you know, it didn't cost much to run a school like that. You understand. You have one primary teacher. Use the boys in the rows to do the teaching. I mean, hey, that's called apprenticeship at its finest, eh? Lasted exactly 50 years. It was absolutely unsustainable. And people knew it. I mean, it just wasn't working. Now, in this same period of time, you have the president of Yale University, Timothy Dwight. He died in 1916, saying, "Education ought everywhere to be a religious education. Parents are further bound to employ no instructors who will not educate their children religiously. To commit our children to the care of irreligious persons is to commit lambs to the superintendency of wolves. You still had voices speaking that way. You had people trying to help the poor. But the resistance to public education continued to wane. They got more and more comfortable with it. And so following the Civil War, okay, it's about 1865, right, to 1910, due to the money flowing into the coffers of the government, there was tremendous growth in public education. During this time, the rise of high schools, preschools, and kindergartens made public education more and more pervasive as the way to do it. By the time the Civil War came, free education, free public education, was accepted in the North, especially. And one of the reasons why was the child labor laws had been passed. And so no longer were they allowed to work. Now, we would say as believers, that was appropriate to not have children working 12, 13, 14 hours a day in terrible conditions. But now what do the children do? We're becoming industrialized. You have cities. You don't have farms as much. Oh, there was lots of farms, but not as many for many people. And during that time, it started creating compulsory attendance laws. So this translated directly into the decline of the Christian school after the Civil War, especially in the North. Immigration overwhelmed Christian schools. Christian schools couldn't handle the numbers coming. Educated pastors were no longer in leadership. And in this time, Horace Mann saw the vacuum in leadership and said, we've got to do something. And stepped up to the plate. Now let me go forward just a little bit. 1925. One of the reasons we can have Christian schools today was because of Pierce versus the Society of Sisters. We are actually indebted to a group of Catholic school teachers in Oregon who took a stand against the attempts by public school officials to force all children to attend their schools. And the court ruling that happened then in favor of the right to have parochial schools mattered. Big time. That was important. And I know you may even have a great-great-grand. I talked with somebody recently at church Sunday, said his grandpa was jailed overnight for not sending his children. We have that in us. But the reason that the court law, the precedent that was set there, was very significant in the future years of our ability to have our own schools. So let me summarize. The Renaissance was a reaction against the Catholic Church of the Middle Ages. And then the Enlightenment was then a reaction against the Protestant Church. The Renaissance revived the pagan classics and brought back Aristotle, Plato, Socrates. The Enlightenment of the 1700s was a rejection of the revelation of Scripture. And they found the answers in man's reasoning, in his intellect, that's where it's found. They had absolute faith in human reasoning. And this Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, brought the philosophers such as Rousseau, Herbart, Froebel, and John Dewey, John Locke, David Hume, Immanuel Kant, George Hegel, Charles Darwin, all from the Enlightenment, a reaction. Naturalism did not do us much good. It said that man is autonomous and not responsible to anyone else. That knowledge and thinking is not connected to God. That man is essentially good. That human nature can become perfect. Obviously, I haven't taught for very many years. They haven't lived very many years in reality, maybe. I'm not sure. And they had a tremendous belief in reason, science, and progress. It enabled the industrial age. There is one man we need to talk about, John Dewey. He was also from that era. He said that education begins with the needs of the child. He said that children determine the curriculum. He said that children learn by doing rather than by instruction from teachers. We only help our students figure out what they want to know. And then they figure out something by doing it. He was strongly influenced by evolution, and he certainly denied absolute truth. You can't find absolute truth. Dewey is a very, very important person in education. There are parts of this, of course, that ring true. There are, aren't there? I mean, the needs of the child are important. You do this. You have a learning disabled child come to your school. You know you can't do everything the same, can you? But it came from a humanistic, naturalistic, enlightened mind that had brought a package with it. From 1850 to 1950, Christian schools all but disappeared except for some smaller groups. So as naturalism, as the age of reason continued to blossom, the Christian community began to realize that public school is no longer an extension of our church. Oh. Now I want to come back at this a little different way. Jewish education in before Christ, you have the first Christian school movement by the early church in Rome. And these schools replaced pagan schools in the Roman Empire. Catholicism rose with the fall of the Roman Empire, and the Catholics outlawed literacy out of fear that reading pagan writings would turn people back to the paganism they had left. Many, many generations of Christians lived underground, as it were, through the next 1,000 years and preserved a quality Christian school. The second Christian school movement was the result of the Reformation, and it spread throughout Europe and the U.S. As government-funded schools became more accepted, this movement diminished until it barely existed in the early 1900s. We then experienced a resurgence in Christian education from the 40s to the 90s. After World War II, believers were awakened to the fact that the public schools were not an extension of the church anymore. And they saw the devastating influence of secularism and humanism, and it didn't help to have the Supreme Court outlaw mandatory prayer and Bible reading. And so now, how was that for a quick trip through 2,500 years? Now let's back up again. I'd like to look at Anabaptism and what happened there. During the Reformation era, Anabaptists, who were largely university trained, blamed a significant amount of the corruption of the Catholic Church on higher learning of priests and preachers. And they felt like, Anabaptists felt like that this kind of education led people away from the practical teachings of Jesus. So they emphasized the simple authority of Scripture. Now, this basic distrust in formerly trained theologians and the fact that they were being persecuted by educated authorities and that they lived rurally, not in the cities, served to foster a significant suspicion about higher education. However, the primary Anabaptist reformers were incredibly well educated. So it is a bit of an anomaly, is it not? Anabaptists have historically been known as radical reformers who were not content to live partial truth, but to die for the truth they saw in the Bible. Richard Hughes says, and I quote, "In a world that prized lockstep uniformity, Anabaptists dared to question the status quo, and they paid for their convictions with their lives." Erasmus, what was his picture on education? "Learning instructs a man in virtue rather than calling him away from it." True learning. Minna Simons, what did he think about it? And trust me, you don't agree with everything Minna Simons taught either. Right? Right. Check out his view on Jesus. "Learning and knowledge of languages I have never in my life despised, but have from my youth honored and loved. Although I have not required them yet, thanks be to God, I am not so bereft of my senses that I should despise or ridicule the knowledge of the languages through which the precious word of divine grace has come to us. I wish from my heart that I and all the pious possessed such learning, if we could in true humility use it rightly to the praise of our God and the service of our neighbor in the pure fear of God." End quote. He's a very significant person in Reformation, was he not? That was his idea. There were a few, we have to be fair. Karlstadt clung to popular Catholic opinion that widespread literacy and learning led to heresy. So he said, can the schools, keep them stupid. I mean, you have these remnant groups among the Anabaptists who had different ideas of non-resistance, for instance, and other things. But historical records of letters and dissertations of the Anabaptists reflect a very high level of literacy for their day. And now I'm going to fast forward you to a story. I'm going to rely heavily, I don't know much about Lancaster County education. And if you're not from Lancaster County, I'm not trying to make a statement here. Donald Crable wrote a book about the story of Lancaster Mennonite High, in which I think he puts into perspective what has happened to create this third Christian school movement. All right? 40s to the 90s. And so I'd like to tell that as a picture. So please stay with me in this. I know it's in a very geographic, all this stuff happened geographically placed, right? But this is a very more specific story, and I think it demonstrates something, and I want you to follow with me in this. Mennonites began arriving in Lancaster County alongside other plain groups, and they had a practical education from the word go. They established the first schools. I just noted that. Wickersham claims that every Mennonite meeting house was either used as a school or affiliated with one. Lancaster County. Church and school life became one, along with neighbors. And Crable claims that by 1834, some 4,000 private schools existed, organized by a variety of religious groups and denominations. Now, while the buildings were somewhat dismal, it was an amazing effort to educate the young. Without the benefit of state direction or tax dollars. Henry Garber, who was a Mennonite minister, said, and I quote, "The church and schoolhouse stood side by side. Christianity and education went hand in hand. The pastor often was the teacher, and the Bible was one of the textbooks." In 1834, the Free School Law established the first public schools in Pennsylvania. So a free education was established under local direction. Now, in Lancaster County, Mennonites soon relinquished their private schools and joined the free school effort. They taught in the schools. There were even directors. In fact, there were several hundred school directors, public school directors, who were Mennonites. I think at one point, Crable talks about 200 directors and 400 teachers who were in the public schools teaching. And so, Mennonites felt at home with these small public schools, where hymns and moral character were taught alongside spelling and math. Soon, they allowed the local districts to establish high schools. And they also mandated they should put flags in the school. Now, there were some skirmishes over the state's demand that the veiling could not be worn because it represents something that they were not comfortable with. And they also had a problem with distinctive garb. But for the most part, Mennonites supported public schools as teachers, directors, and pupils in almost every township in Lancaster County. As the Great Depression eased, Mennonites began to wonder if they should have so easily embraced public education. There was the issue of the flag salute. What do you do with that? A.D. Wanger said, and I quote, "The old question was, shall we educate or not? But the new question was, who should educate our children? Shall we let the state with fairy tales, entertainments, militarism, and evolution crush out the simple faith implanted by loving fathers and mothers?" About this time, a former public school teacher, Henry Garber, began advocating church schools. He believed that loyal schools of the church would bear fruit and be a blessing. He said, "The moral standards are alarmingly low. I know I'm in them." He thought church schools will actually train Christian young people for service. The public system began to do this thing called consolidation. If you're Canadian, I don't know what the background is in Canada, but in the U.S., we still have consolidation going on all the time, closing down public schools. That's what this building is. It brought some things together, dumped this building, put it together. Pretty soon you meld this and put this thing together. Consolidation, big deal. And it really caused the first Amish school to open in 1937. Also, the Locust Grove Mennonite School started at that time, the first Mennonite school in the 1900s in Pennsylvania. Now, the bishops permitted these schools to start, but didn't actively promote them. 39 elementary schools, Mennonite elementary schools, started from 1940 to 1949. Now, it is not the same everywhere else. Everyone else is behind in this. Annual meetings to promote schools were started. There were teacher training conferences held on a regular basis. There were nearly 100 articles on Christian schools published in the Gospel Herald. 1940, Henry Garber had five reasons he said we should establish a Mennonite high school. He said, number one, the law says so. Children are to remain in school till they're 17. Actually, that law is still in place, Pennsylvania. Number two, moral conditions of high schools were disturbing. So number three, evolution's taught. Number four, the extracurricular activities didn't harmonize with Scripture or church practice. He said, how can we make sense of this? How will young people make sense of this? And he said, in a Mennonite school, our own brethren can instruct and guide our youth to safeguard them from an apostate and pleasure-loving world. In other words, public schools seem to be leading young people away from the church rather than to it. And one way they knew this was that Mennonites started marrying public school children. They said, well, wait, what's going on here? Oh, maybe the school's part of this. A Mennonite minister, John Gochnauer, wrote to a newspaper about what's wrong with our schools. And he listed a whole host of things. He said that by going to the public system, we compromise with the world. He said the teachers question deity of Christ and inspiration of Scripture. He said students are taught the facts of untested theory instead of simple voice of revelation. He said ancient history is not taught that includes biblical characters. By the way, does your history include that? Do you teach biblical characters as you teach history? Check a table out over there. Recreational and social activity stimulate a desire for the lure and appeal of the dance and movie rather than the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit. He said competitive sports interfere with classroom work. He said girls need to wear slacks or shorts in phys ed to the detriment, I'm quoting, to the detriment of the sense of modesty that is vital to the charms of Christian youth, unquote. There was repulsive behavior pervading washrooms. That hasn't changed in our Christian schools either, has it? Growing political tendency, creating state-minded youth, flag salute, war stamps and bonds, fascination for military activities and training, and all this he wrote in the newspaper, editorial, about this. You begin to see a bit of religious fervor going on here, don't you? You feel something going on inside these men. The articles and speeches shared a common fear of the state system and state-controlled schools. Donald Crable says, and I quote, "The magic of the factory, specialization, professionalism, standardization, centralization, and efficiency, the magic that produced Model T cars and vacuum cleaners galore, was shaping the character of public education, and Mennonites didn't like it." There was a shift of power during this time from the local level to the state level. So now no longer are people on the board and directors and teachers, state took it. There were deeper trends that were even more significant. Factory work and professional jobs were beginning to transform family life. No longer are you on the farm. Schools were not only a place to learn the subjects, they were the center of social life as well. Drama, sports, dances, other activities drew students away from home and to farmers. Things like phys ed made no sense. Buck hay, for crying out loud. What's this thing about running in circles, putting balls through something, kicking? What's the deal? For families interested in a basic education, all these activities were not only frivolous, but they also enticed the young people away from the barn and the fields
But remember, there's a movement going on here. Specialization. They were exposed, the public system exposed young people to worldly amusements outside the watchful family, outside the watchful eye of the family. In short, people began to see that the new public schools threatened to unveil, to unravel the heart of the Mennonite family. They saw that modern education was emphasizing science and rational thinking. They were producing independent thinkers. They didn't necessarily come under the church, independent thinkers. They saw self-achievement and individual rights that were so touted by the public system in this time, antithetical to what the Mennonite leadership wanted. For a people who hoped to remain separate from the world, who believed that faith in Jesus led them away from the mainstream rather than into it, the transformation of public education was very, very threatening. Lancaster Mennonite High was born. Of course, probably most of us know where it's at today. I'm not going to finish the story. You can read the book for yourself. And of course, depends who writes the books will define how you talk about the progression that happened. For us as conservative Anabaptists, we started off so good, ended up not ending so good. But this kind of feeling was pervasive increasingly from the 40s through the 60s. By the time you hit the 60s, you now have all over this thing sometimes called the hippie movement, right? And the decadence in the schools was astonishing. Fear really did set in. We're going to pick up tomorrow right there.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.